Okay, so I'm going to be talking today about soil moisture sensor data that we've been collecting from a sensor network up near Pullman, Washington, and I have to recognize my co-authors, a group that we worked with over in Europe who helped develop some of the models that I'll be talking about. So we know that soil moisture is a major control on soil biogeochemistry and other processes in crop growth, and in order to understand the dynamics of soil moisture, we need measurements in high spatial and temporal resolution. And sensor networks can assist this effort. But once we have that point data, a big important step is to interpolate that point data into continuous predictions that we can then use to input into process or biophysical models, so then we can learn something about the field that we're studying. So I'm just going to talk today about this interpolation step and tell you about some of the models that we've developed to help us with handling a highly dimensional data set. And the work I'm going to be talking about takes place on Cook Farm, which is an experimental farm near Pullman, Washington. And there's a photo here just of one part of the farm, but you can see some of the terrain that we're dealing with. So the R.J. Cook Agronomy Farm is a long-term agroecological research site stationed near Pullman, Washington. It's a no-till, direct seed, cereal and legume rotation field, and you can see these different cropping strips that serve as the basis for the rotation each year. So we're dealing with complex terrain, as you saw in the previous slide. The Palouse is very hilly, and it has variable and discontinuous soil horizonation that doesn't necessarily follow the terrain. So we're dealing with interesting accumulations of clay that's not continuous over the field. It is not irrigated, so we're working in a dry land system with Mediterranean climate where we receive our precipitation in the winter. So across the 37-hectare farm, we have 42 locations. They're symbolized here with these blue triangles. And at each of those 42 locations, we have sensors installed at five different depths, 30, 60, 90, 120, and 150 centimeters, with data loggers buried, and we use the Decagon 5TE sensors that collect volumetric water content, temperature, and electrical conductivity. I'm just going to be talking about water content. And they've been collecting hourly data since 2009. So we have a lot of data to work with, and everything that we've done so far has just been working with daily aggregates. So I'm just going to zoom into one of these locations and show you a time series of some of this data. So on the top graph here, we have volumetric water content on the y-axis and the water content through three different years at each of the depths. And so you can just see that with depth, the fluctuations vary, but you do see that seasonality in the dry land agricultural system. And on the bottom here, we have a histogram of by depth of all locations and all readings. So this is just an aggregation of all of our data. The darker symbol does indicate more observations. And so you see that there's more water retention as you increase in depth, which is pretty straightforward and reasonable. So the step here to take these space-time points and turn them into continuous estimates or predictions in a 3D plus time kind of prediction framework, we started from the regression Krieging framework that's already been applied widely to soil mapping in two dimensions, three dimensions, and two dimensions, and through time. And up to this point, we really lacked a theoretical and analytical framework for doing this, and in part, it's because we just haven't had the data. And as you increase in dimensionality, the number of observations that you need to be able to make accurate predictions really blows up. And so here you can see that in this figure. And for this data set that we're working with, we have just under 250,000 observations, which is a lot of data. And so it does allow us to actually try to develop these 3D plus time interpolation models. So here we're just starting with a typical regression Krieging framework. We're modeling a property Z that has a spatial location, an X and a Y, the depth, and also a timestamp, and usually we would model it as having a mean, some spatially and temporally correlated errors, and some non-correlated noise. That's what each of these stand for. So we took two different approaches. The first is using a multiple regression to kind of just focus on this mean part of the model. And we're putting in all of our different covariate layers, and so that's why this is so long. We have two-dimensional covariates, three-dimensional, two-dimensional and through time, a temporal covariate, and then another cumulative day covariate that's just another temporal covariate, one-dimensional. So that was one approach, just using a multiple regression, using random forest algorithms. And I'll talk more about each of those covariate layers in the next slide. And then the other approach is just to use a seasonality function to detrend the data. As you saw, it differs a little bit by depth, and so we fit a seasonal trend to each of the depths, and then we obtain the residuals and use ordinary kriging to predict using a three-dimensional semivariogram to make those predictions through time and space. And the semivariograms here are a little different. We have a spatial component, temporal component, and a combination. Okay, so just to talk about our covariate layers, the inputs that we put into our regression model. For two-dimensional covariates, we have an elevation model, wetness index. This is our vegetation index that's sensitive to chlorophyll content. Gives us a lot of information about the variability of the vegetation. We have three-dimensional covariates, so from soil profile data, we built three-dimensional models that describe the presence and absence or the probability of encountering a BT horizon. We have bulk density and also soil pH. And then for our temporal covariates, we have cumulative precipitation, minimum and maximum air temperature, and then, as I mentioned, that cumulative day covariate that we also created. And then we also have the crop identity across the field each year, so that serves as a spatiotemporal covariate. So when we put all of those into a random forest regression model, we see that cumulative day really comes out as the most important covariate. So this temporal component, the temporal correlation, is really strong and serves as a strong predictor of water content. And we also see that with the full model, so all observations included in the random forest model, we get a really high goodness of fit with 93% of the variability explained in the observations. As for the detrended residuals semivariogram model, we learned that the spatial correlation is stronger over the vertical distance than horizontal distance or with depth, which makes sense because as we go down in the profile, we encounter different horizons. And we also learned, as with the last model, that the correlation occurs over much longer temporal separation than spatial separation. And so you can kind of see that the range of this three-dimensional semivariogram kind of is shown here, but the time range is it would probably end up way over here. I don't know, in Las Vegas, it's like so far away at this scale. So temporal components are really strong in determining some water content in both models. And then when we take a look at cross-validation, as I mentioned, the goodness of fit of the regression model was really high, but when we do a really rigorous leave one station out and iterate through 42 different models to predict at the missing location, we see a reduction in our R-squared down to about 34% along, and that's comparable to our kriging model. So they're performing equally well according to cross-validation. But if we look at the predictions, here's the random forest model, and you can see, so these are the different depths, and this is through the month of July in 2012. And so this is when we see a lot of water drawdown by the crop. And the top two depths are, it's really hard to see because they're already dry. But what you do see later on in July is that you can kind of see some cropping strips coming out in the model. You can also see some locations that stay wet later into the dry season. Those are draws on the field. And then you also see some locations that kind of appear to start drying, and those are kind of the tops of the ridges. So we are seeing some terrain and cropping influences coming out in these predictive models. And that's opposed to the kriging model, which this looks kind of like a typical ordinary kriging map where you have this very speckled appearance, and really you're not getting any information about terrain or cropping system or soils or anything like that. It's really just telling us what kind of spatial dependency surrounds each sample point. So here's just a quick animation. I want to show you another way to visualize this data. So that's been a challenge, just trying to visualize three-dimensional and time data. And so here we have our 30-centimeter depth and then our 150-centimeter depth. And these are also from, these are the same layers that I just showed you in the previous slides. But this is from the random forest model. Whoops. And so this is cycling through that month in July. And you'll be able to see these patches come out that are drying later in the season. So it's just another way to visualize the data. It's going to loop through one more time. Okay, so temporal patterns and our seasonality have much stronger influences on both of the models than the spatial relationships, and that's maybe not entirely something that we expected, but it does make sense. If you think back to those time series graphs, we do have quite a bit of seasonality and fluctuations over the growing season, and that turns out to be really important in the predictions. So according to cross-validation, both models performed equally well, but as you saw, the random forest model really reflects some of the landscape patterns that we do see when we're out there. And the Krieging model might be fitting some of the error. We have had some issues with the calibration. As I've mentioned, the soils are extremely variable at Cook Farm, and calibrating 210 sensors to soil-specific calibration curves is just not an option. So we've been working on some retroactive calibration methods. And I actually have a poster on that this afternoon if you're interested in that. But so as we refine and improve the data inputs that we're putting into these models, then we expect to have stronger predictive power when we have much more confidence in the accuracy of our sensor data, as well as our covariates. And so we're working on developing some much more detailed three-dimensional covariate maps that help us understand the clay content, the texture, and where that water might be hanging out at different times of the season. So that's that, and I'd be happy to take questions if there's time. And that was something, so it's been a work in progress. Initially, the data loggers were stored above ground, and since it's a working farm, that was really challenging because every time that there was an operation on the farm, we had to disconnect the data loggers from the sensors and bury them, and sometimes the cables would be hit by machinery and splice. Sensors also have a limited lifespan, and so they just expire after a couple years or longer, and so there are missing data gaps, and that's one thing that we can address with these predictive models is we can fill in those missing data gaps.
Thank you, Kaylee.